Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how mercury fillings, the silver fillings in your mouth, cause candida overgrowth. Then we're going to talk about could yogurt, both dairy and non-dairy yogurt, keep diabetes away? Harvard School of Public Health. And how a new study about the hepatitis E vaccination in France sparked a wave of new cases of multiple sclerosis. Also, a natural compound could reduce breast cancer risk in some women, University of Missouri, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, I'm going to take you behind the scenes to show you why it is so easy to be convinced that vaccines are both safe and effective, and anyone suggesting otherwise is just a crackpot, misinformed, pseudoscientific, or so says the experts. Here's what you're not shown. Let's pull back the curtain and see the magical wizard of pharma. And you're going to see today specifics, very detailed specifics, that you could use in a court of law. That's the level of scholarship we're sharing, where we will name the organizations, the colleges, the departments, the amount of money they receive from Big Pharma, and especially when it comes to vaccinations. And therefore, they go forth onto the media to say, vaccines are safe and effective, professor such and such in this university, end of story. But it's not. If that person is making a statement, then it's pro-vaccine, based upon a financial conflict of interest. Also today, we will show you the dark side of vaccine legacy, and that is that millions of Americans, upwards of 90 million by some estimates, received a contaminated polio vaccine between 1955 and 1963. I'm going to be sharing an article. It was entitled Ticking Time Bomb and 40-Year Legacy of Tainted Polio Vaccine, and about what was in the polio vaccine that we all received and what that could be doing to our health today. Also, a letter from a young lady, Gardasil, destroyed and abandoned, and a lot more just common sense questions on vaccination. Also today, why we can't trust the mainstream media about drugs and vaccines. And then I will share an in-depth look at the real creation of ISIS, because yes, ISIS is a threat, no question about that. They are complete sociopaths and psychopaths, clear about that also. But how did they originate? And you've heard from the internet some people making some suggestions the United States may have had something to do with it. We'll give you the details of exactly how ISIS started, how it spread, and what role the United States played in that process. Also, if time permits today, a West Point professor calls on U.S. military to target any critic of the war on terror. That's correct. Now, is this from the New York Times? No, this is from The Guardian, Spencer Ackerman. And I thought it was worth sharing this with you. I don't know if we'll have time, but I want to get Gerald Salante in to give his views on ISIS. And then, following yesterday's program, which hit a nerve with some people, and it got their attention, especially when I mentioned that there are 13 million really poor people in California, I want to play a clip from Professor Robert Reich on inequality. Also from today, from Adam McLean, the newest research from the National Center for Homeless Families at the American Institute for Research, 500,000 California children are homeless. That's a low figure. 500,000 just in California. So that all ties together. especially in this context. And I think we have to pull back far enough to see the real issue. California is the wealthiest state in America. They have over 100 billionaires. They account for an awful lot of the worst case scenario for children in the United States. They have some of the most expensive real estate in the United States. And yet you have millions of Americans living in California who simply cannot make ends meet. Some are living out of their cars or abandoned buildings or doubling up with family members or friends. So what do? Well, they then make it against the law to live in a trailer or in the city limits or to live in a car. So if you are too poor to afford to live anywhere else except your car, now you'll get a fine. And if you don't pay the fine, you can go to jail for living in your car. What kind of sensibility is this? There's just something fundamentally flawed when you punish those who are least able to defend themselves, take care of themselves. What for what? You're sitting on a council? What kind of people sit on the councils that make these rules? It's just like in 60 communities in the United States today, it's against the law to feed the homeless. So we call ourselves a Christian nation. What kind of Christian are you? What kind of religious person are you? Jewish? Islamic? What Muslim? What actually is the nature of your belief if you would be one of the people who would either vote to enact a law that punishes those, including children, who are at poverty door, and then punish people who want to help them? Says a lot about our character as a nation. Not just these laws exist, but they aren't repealed. And the people who are putting them into place are still in office. That concerns me. And that's why I produced the film Poverty Inc., which, by the way, I believe I was just told today has won more awards this year in the last 6 months than any other documentary presented in the United States. Now, we'll list all the different important film festivals it's in. It's worth watching that film to get an idea of how bad it is. But let's start with something that people don't consider bad at all, the silver fillings in your mouth. We call them silver fillings, but they're actually 52% mercury. Now, the question then is how mercury fillings can cause candida overgrowth, which is very common. And candida in and of itself is not bad. It's just what percentage of your body's candida is an overgrowth, because you'll always have some candida. But it's when you get too much of it and you end up with what we call candidiasis. And then it's all kinds of problems. Bad breath is one of the first things you have. And then yeast infections, rectal yeast infections, vaginal yeast infections. And if you get it really bad, you can actually get it into your lungs. Well, one of the problems is mercury. Now, mercury is one of the most toxic substances ever, and yet we're walking around with our mouths filled with it. And what we don't appreciate is that very small particles are breaking free every time you're chewing, inhaling, or swallowing. In fact, the mercury release is 50 times higher for those who have mercury fillings capped with gold. And you can't get rid of this mercury. There's no mechanism biologically in the body for the body to say, okay, this is mercury, we don't need it, it's good for nothing, let's get rid of it. Its molecular structure is so similar to selenium, which the body does need, that instead of expelling it, frequently the body is holding the mineral, or holding mercury along with other minerals. And in the gut, mercury creates an environment that is not friendly for other bacteria. As a result, it kills good bacteria and allows proliferation and overgrowth of bad bacteria, and that's where you get candida. Now, when you remove mercury, which a holistic dentist can do, and it's done properly, you can really see the difference. You start taking 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 mercury fillings out of a person's mouth, one of the first things they say is that their cognition comes back, their memory improves, their immune function is heightened, their energy when they wake up in the morning is much greater. And mercury is so toxic, removing the fillings must be done by a dentist who then follows a process. And I would use a biological dentist, also called a holistic dentist, and they're trained in the safe removal of the amalgam fillings. And when mercury fillings are removed, they break apart, releasing particles of mercury. And they also release vapor. And proper protocol involves covering every patch of your skin that could be exposed, as well as protecting your airways, and what's called a dam. And this is done with goggles to protect your eyes, a forced air breathing apparatus, an extra suction, draping to cover your face, and a rubber dam to prevent swallowing particles and inhaling vapors. And cold water should also be used to minimize vaporization, and you have to rinse your mouth thoroughly. But once it's done, then you'll see a big difference and get off the sugar and alcohol and refined carbohydrates. It can make a difference. Also, yogurt. Now, I'm referring to non-dairy yogurt, but the science was based on dairy yogurt. It was an article published in the British Medical Journal, and what they found is that from Harvard School of Public Health, they did the research, quote, "A high intake of yogurt may be associated with a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes." And this is a meta-analysis, meaning many studies, and they're looking at a 28-ounce serving of yogurt per day, 28 grams. 20 grams is 1 ounce, and that's a very small amount. And, quote, this is from the study, Harvard School of Public Health. "We found that higher intake of yogurts is associated with a reduced risk of type 2 diabetes, whereas other dairy foods and consumption of total dairy did not show this association. This consistent findings for yogurt suggests it can be incorporated into a healthy dietary pattern." All right. My take on this is simple. It's not the dairy, because they already state that they could find no benefit with regular dairy. It's the fermentation, which means it is the probiotics, the lactobacillus. Hence, using a coconut yogurt or a rice yogurt that has the same amount of probiotics should be able to accomplish the same thing. So that's good news. And also, there has been some suspicion of a link between the hepatitis B vaccines and the development of multiple sclerosis. According to Overcoming Multiple Sclerosis, this new study examined detailed national data in France around the mass vaccination of French adults in the mid-1990s. Following World Health Organization recommendations of a mass vaccine program against hepatitis B to eradicate the virus. So 20 million French citizens were vaccinated in a 3-year period. And then they started seeing this huge increase, a sudden increase out of nowhere, multiple sclerosis developing in France. And they then linked that to the mass vaccine program. And vaccine numbers then began to fall. And now when they look back at the data, they see multiple sclerosis began to fall also as the vaccine numbers. So once again, long after the fact, we find that a vaccine program that was meant to help did not. Also, from Sayer G, AgreeMed Info, vaccines don't work. Quote, "Malignant mumps is in the MMR vaccinated children." I thought this was very important because this is one of the mandated vaccines at the state level that the kids must get. Quote, "A provocative new study titled Epidemic of Complicated Mumps in Previously Vaccinated Young Adults in Southwest of France reveals that the MMR vaccine, despite generating high rates of presumably protective IgG antibodies against mumps, does not always translate into real-world immunity against infection, as we have repeatedly been told. To the contrary, the study detailed cases where, despite the detection of high levels of antibodies against the mumps virus, patients contracted a malignant form of mumps that only rarely follows from natural community-acquired infection." And so there is just one example, and he goes on in detail to explain how bad it is. Now, I also want to share something with you about a compound, and this called lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, lutein. And the good news is, according to University of Missouri, that it can inhibit the growth of human breast cancer cells in postmenopausal women, especially those taking hormone replacement therapy. Here's the bad news. 100 women a day, minimally, die of breast cancer in the United States. The odds increase tremendously in postmenopausal women who've taken a combined estrogen and progestin hormone replacement therapy, which I've been opposed to. I've written about it. I suggest women never, ever, ever use synthetic hormone replacement therapy. It is not indicated. It is counterindicated. We have all the studies showing it increases your risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, dementia, heart attack, and stroke at a very high rate. Now, this, however, this compound, this lutein, is a natural compound found in herbs like thyme and parsley, as well as celery and broccoli, and it can reduce the cancer risk for women who have taken hormone replacement therapy. So they're going to say that hormone replacement therapy, you know, supports a person's quality of life. Well, it may turn off hot flashes, but we can turn off hot flashes very easily. First, you give up coffee. That's one of the primary problems. And also for any woman with an ovarian cyst or breast cancer, a breast cyst, you want to give up coffee because it causes a growth. It's very anabolic to cancer. Then you start giving up all animal proteins and go to a plant-based diet, and then you take Vitex, black cohosh, blue cohosh, squall vine, and dong quai, and you suddenly can see an enormous difference in hot flashes. So that's the good news on that. Now, also, we now know that the heat compound from chili peppers could help kill cancer cells. Now, who's telling us this? This is from the American Chemical Society. The ingredient is called capsaicin, and it's responsible for the heat. Now, you've seen it, I'm sure, in some creams that you apply to relieve pain in your joints. But it also kills prostate cancer cells. New research is finding clues that help explain how the substance works. And their conclusions suggest that it can work, and it was published in the Journal of Physical Chemistry. Based upon all this, they're saying, yes, capsaicin can kill prostate cancer cells in laboratory. Well, why not kill other cells as well? Because they didn't test it on other cancers. So in any good quality cancer protocol to prevent cancer, I would use a high heat index capsaicin capsules each day, one. To help prevent a heart attack or stroke, I would use two, and especially before you go to bed at night, and also to help if you have cancer, you could even use three. Also, they're showing some improvement, according to the University of South Florida, in human umbilical cord blood improving cognition in Alzheimer's disease in this one particular model they're using. I thought that was interesting. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Transplantation. And so what they're doing is they're using something that is anti-inflammatory. But there are other things you can use anti-inflammatory. Why not use L-carnosine and resveratrol together? 1,000 milligrams of L-carnosine and 200 milligrams of resveratrol together with 500 milligrams of ginkgo biloba for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia. That is doable now. This is just showing you some of the research and where they're going with it. Also, the stomach bacteria determines which diet is best for weight reduction. This is from Chalmers University of Technology. And they're finding that the microbiome, and that's your bacteria in the intestines, if it's a good bacteria, and a good bacteria comes from eating good foods. It's real simple. Real simple. Good bacteria, fruits, vegetables, legumes, tubers, like squash, rutabaga, kohlrabi, parsnips, turnips, sweet potatoes, yams, whole grains, beans of every kind, seeds, sunflower seeds, sesame seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, and juices, all feed good bacteria. That, in turn, creates a really healthy medium in your intestine and throughout the rest of your body. Whereas sugar, dead, denatured, and processed foods create bad bacteria. Alcohol really creates bad bacteria. And antibiotics destroy all bacteria, allowing the bad bacteria then to thrive. So if you want to lose weight, have healthier bacteria. And also, you can give yourself good bacteria every day, between 5 to 20 billion, with a B, bacteria would be really good for most people. Also, from psychosomatic obstetrics and gynecology, a good study that shows that how childhood stress can impact female fertility. And what they found is they had a hypothesis, could early adverse effects in childhood, bad times in childhood, trauma, abuse, could that impact a woman later in life? And they found, yes, it can. Everything from having menstrual cycle irregularities, which consequently impact fertility. And so that's that epigenetics. Whatever happens earlier in life can sure impact your entire reproductive system later in life. Quote from the study. Early life stressors may predispose an individual to adaptively suppress fertility when situations are less than optimal, leading to periods of fertility difficulties even following previous births. So, also from Newcastle University, published in a European Journal of Diabetics, brief bouts of exercise begin to reverse heart abnormalities in people with type 2 diabetes. Now, why is this important? Because type 2 diabetes is a killer. As I mentioned yesterday on this program, it is the number one disease in America. It has more impact than heart disease and cancer combined. And now half of all adults are diabetic or pre-diabetic. That means you're going to have a greater likelihood of a heart attack or a stroke or congestive heart failure. This is what it says. Quote, people with type 2 diabetes are twice as likely as those without diabetes to have heart disease, and heart disease is the leading cause of death and complications for people with type 2 diabetes. The effect of diabetes on the heart happens early with changes in the structure and function of the left ventricle, the heart's main pump, and prior to any symptomatic cardiac disease. And despite the importance of the heart, there are few treatment options to improve its structure and function. A physically active lifestyle is known to help manage type 2 diabetes and is recommended alongside a good diet. So now they're studying these people in this one study. It was a randomized study, 12 weeks of high-intensity intermittent exercise. And those who continued to do this had, quote, cardiac structure and function were measured using advanced magnetic resonance imaging, there's your MRI, techniques, and diabetes control was assessed by a standard oral glucose tolerance test. The researchers found that a high-intensity intermittent exercise significantly improved cardiac structure and function. The exercise particularly benefited the left ventricle, identified to be altered with type 2 diabetes, which was shown to become stronger and work more efficiently. There was a significant but modest improvement in diabetes control. So, quote from the study, this study demonstrates for the first time that exercise can begin to reverse some of the early cardiac changes that are commonly found in people with type 2 diabetes. Good. That's great. And one more good piece of information, powerful. This is from University of Dusseldorf and University of Reading. I remember going to University of Dusseldorf and doing research. long time ago on cell therapy. Because in the United States, I was told by a person at the FDA, there is no such thing. And there they had 500 studies. And they were doing it with some phenomenal results. Anyhow, they found that flavanols found in coca and other foods could have a beneficial effect on cardiovascular health, reducing blood pressure. And the study was a large-scale study. So they're looking at 450 milligrams. That's a half a gram. That's a really small amount. I mean, that's, well, let me just put that into some kind of visual. Imagine a pea, a little tiny green pea, all right? That's how small that is. So I think people should take a lot more than that, 2 ounces twice a day of a dark chocolate. Yeah, that will help your heart. It improves blood pressure and cardiac health. And quote from the study, the cocoa flavanol studies approaches the blood pressure lowering effect sizes observed in typical blood pressure lowering medications. Wow. So eating dark, healthy chocolate did the same thing as the medications, and the medications have serious side effects. So that's good. And, one more here. I'll keep you in touch on this one. A Ministry of Health in the Netherlands, that's where the Dutch are, they're going to do a study starting in about 2 months where they're giving for a year at 7 prisons where they're having prisoners who are violent. And they're giving them vitamins, minerals, and fish oil, according to the Justice Ministry. Quote, 2 previous experiments have shown that aggressive prisoners who receive food supplements show less aggression than those who do not. And so that's good. And I'll let you know how that's going. I'm going to be writing them today and sending them over some studies, including some studies that were done by Dr. Schoenthaler and Dr. Alexander Schaus, who I was consulting with at the time, where they took sugar and dairy out of prison systems, and in those systems they took the sugar and the dairy out, there was an enormous change in violence, substantially receded. So if you also took the sugar and dairy out of schools programs, out of prison programs, and you started giving them healthy foods, imagine the difference. Could make some big difference there. And by the way, for those who have AIDS-defining illnesses, a study that was done at a major university in China and published by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which is like our National Academy of Sciences, found that a particular derivative of the herb's lignin, that's L-I-G-N-I-N, extracted from the leaves and stems of a woody vine plant, have strong anti-HIV properties, low toxicity, and, quote, the lab-engineered derivatives can kill HIV, so the findings pave the way for future anti-HIV drug research and development. Why have a drug? You've got the actual plant, and it grows all over China. It's inexpensive, so why not use it? So, anyhow, that's the latest. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go directly from the break into having an honest look on the origins of ISIS, the major terrorist organization operating throughout parts of Africa, Libya in a big way, Syria in a big way, and how we in the United States were the progenitor. We helped create ISIS. Please stay with us.
most important story in the country. The next major war for the United States is with ISIS. But what media and politicians are not telling you the truth about, where ISIS came from, who created them, and why before one more dollar is spent, one more American life lost, you need to know the truth. The first step toward truth is to be informed. The name ISIS is one that every American knows by now. The biggest threat to our national security since Al-Qaeda, right? They are a brutal, savage group known for public beheadings and mass executions. They are the face of the new war on terror. Right now, the U.S. military is conducting airstrikes in Syria in a supposed attempt to take out ISIS targets. Meanwhile, the White House and military leaders are talking about possible boots on the ground in Iraq again, only 3 years after the war in Iraq was declared over. In fact, this war, according to former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, could last for decades.
I think we're looking at kind of a 30-year war kind of history here.
Allahu Akbar!
So who exactly is ISIS, and where did they come from?
It's entirely a creation of the United States' behavior in Iraq. That's how we got to where we are, because of war, because of occupation, because of torture.
For answers, we traveled to Los Angeles to meet with Angela Keaton, the founder of antiwar.com.
We destabilized and wrecked Iraq. I mean, it caused it to fail miserably, and that's entirely the responsibility of the United States government. There's no one else at fault there. I mean, as horrible as Saddam Hussein was, Iraq was not unstable. It was a functioning country, as much as those sorts of things go, and was not a particularly horrible hellhole if you were a religious minority.
To understand where ISIS comes from, you have to understand two storylines. The first is what Keaton just said. When the U.S. first went into Iraq, we blew the country apart. We destroyed the government, toppled Saddam Hussein, destroyed infrastructure, and most importantly, left behind a power vacuum. One that would have never have existed had Hussein not been overthrown by the U.S. government. Daniel McAdams with the Ron Paul Institute says this is an historical fact that media just won't discuss.
All of this has to do with U.S. action in the region, which destroyed the infrastructure, which destroyed Iraqi society, which destroyed the government. You had a lot of people who lived under Saddam Hussein, who may not have been as happy as larks. Nevertheless, they were living somewhat normal lives. The U.S. put a government in power in Baghdad that all of a sudden was their enemies, that treated them very, very badly.
Now, that is the easy part of the story. The U.S. created conditions in Iraq where ISIS could get its start. But here's the other storyline that you have to understand, that even with Saddam gone, ISIS still couldn't have risen to power had it not been for what happened next. ISIS actually began as a small insurgent group in Iraq in 2006. They had no money, no real ability to recruit, but they did work to create very limited problems for the U.S. military. It wasn't until 2009 that ISIS shifted its focus from Iraq, where it was largely unsuccessful in developing a foothold, and focused on the civil war in Syria. Even there, ISIS struggled to gain any foothold, because the two largest groups fighting against President Bashar al-Assad were al-Nusra Front, or al-Qaeda, and the Free Syrian Army. Then came a pivotal moment that most Americans aren't even aware of. In June of 2013, a northern general for the Free Syrian Army spoke out on Al Jazeera Qatar and stated that if international forces did not send weapons, the rebels attempting to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would lose their war in just 1 month. Well, only months before, I had personally confronted President Obama about why the U.S. was covertly funding those Syrian rebels.
And yet there's some concern about the U.S. funding the Syrian opposition when there are a lot of reports that al-Qaeda is kind of heading up that opposition. How do you justify the two?
Well, I share that concern. And so what we've done is to say, we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
So even as the president acted as if he was being careful, politicians like Senator John McCain demanded action.
So it's a totally unfair and unbalanced fight. And now the rebels are the freedom fighters. The Syrian National Army are being beaten every place around Syria because of the overwhelming firepower. And air power is really the deciding factor. So you've got to take their air power out of it. You've got to have a safe zone where they can operate, train, and equip. And we've got to turn this thing around.
So what happened? Well, within just a matter of weeks of that Syrian general making his plea for international help, the U.S., the Saudis, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, and Israel began providing weapons and training and money to the so-called rebel Free Syrian Army. By September of 2013, American media outlets, including CNN and the Washington Post, were reporting that CIA-funded weapons had begun flowing to Syrian rebels. The weapons were not American-made, but funded and organized by the CIA. The artillery was described as light weapons, some anti-tank weapons, and ammunition. But where it all fell apart, weapons that the U.S. insisted would be used by freedom fighters would be in less than 1 year in the hands of ISIS fighters. So where were these fighters coming from? Actually, from the Free Syrian Army, the group that John McCain insisted would help the U.S. to overthrow Assad. That same group actually giving weapons, selling weapons, and sending fighters to join with this new group called the Islamic State. It was in June of 2014 when suddenly, after being a no-name group in Syria, that ISIS emerged, heavily armed and trained by U.S. and coalition special forces, making a dramatic entrance by crossing back over the Syrian border into Iraq, capturing Mosul and much of the northern part of the country. One of the most important facts that mainstream media ignores time and time again is that ISIS was able to grow so fast because of all the U.S. military equipment they were able to seize, equipment that our military left in Iraq, truckloads of Humvees, tanks, and weaponry that instead of taking or destroying, the U.S. government simply decided to leave behind. Even when the U.S. government knew that ISIS fighters were capturing that equipment, for crying out loud, these guys were posting pictures of themselves driving and standing on U.S. military equipment, making video of themselves with it. We did nothing. Why?
How is it the U.S. had no idea that this threat was coming? How many billions do we spend? Maybe $100 billion on the total intelligence community budget over the year? How is it that they had no idea? How is it that if this was such a threat, as John McCain and Lindsey Graham are fond of reminding us, how is it that it was missed so unbelievably, so egregiously?
Over the past few months, the U.S. government, who acted like they had never even heard of ISIS, suddenly, with the help of media, has turned the Islamic State into the new focus of the war on terror. Now, as ISIS has continued its rise, recruitment is exploding, and the group is becoming stunningly wealthy.
ISIS is the best funded terrorist group in the world. They make some, I think it's $2 million a day selling oil, much of it to Turkey, interestingly enough. And if you look at the U.S. response to this, the U.S. response to ISIS becoming extremely rich by selling oil and undercutting the competition is to blow up the oil fields, which to me makes no sense. You're blowing up the infrastructure. It happens to be in Syria, so you might think that there is another motive there. But why wouldn't you, the U.S. sanctions anything that moves when it's angry? Why can't you sanction the banks that are helping finance these deals? Why can't you sanction the oil companies that are participating in this? Why do you blow up the oil fields?
It's a great question. And here are some other questions that defy logic when you start looking for answers. Why is the U.S. sending $500 million to the Free Syrian Army to fight ISIS when the FSA is one of the biggest suppliers of fighters and weapons to ISIS? Why are we sending new and more powerful weapons to the FSA, like anti-aircraft missiles, weapons that we know will end up in the hands of ISIS?
ISIS, of course, is going to now have anti-aircraft missiles provided by the U.S. and the Saudis. The Saudis are getting them from the Chinese, though, now, so there can be plausible deniability, because inevitably these sweethearts in the sweetheart rebel groups in Syria are going to start shooting down, if they have the ability, passenger jets. And then we're going to want the plausible deniability. Say, no, it's the Chinese weaponry, as if it's going to make any difference.
Well, there are so many questions that we could ask, but let's just cut to the chase here, because what you need to know about this is that ISIS is not the creation of American inaction, which is what the media is going to tell you. No, they are the product of direct action. First, the action of creating a power vacuum in Iraq, and secondly, arming violent jihadists, hoping they would overthrow a leader in a neighboring Middle Eastern country. McAdams says the U.S. government is a victim of its own insane policies.
Well, I think the U.S. is really a hostage to its own regime change philosophy. The U.S. is very good at blowing things up and destroying societies, but it is very, very bad at putting them back together.
Is that true? Well, you decide. Fact. Our government armed Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and created Al-Qaeda. Fact. Our government helped supply Saddam Hussein chemical weapons for him to use against Iran in 1980 and then overthrew him in 2003. Fact. Our government trained rebel fighters in Syria who would become the group today known as ISIS or the Islamic State. We have watched them commit every violent atrocity that you can imagine to people living in Iraq and Syria. And now we want American taxpayers to fund a 30-year war against them. No, it's not the U.S. government being held hostage by these crazy policies. It's the American people. And it's time that we reject the destruction of people groups around the world for the sake of foreign policy that makes so-called defense contractors rich and perpetuates violence, death, and destruction of entire people groups. Because humanity is greater than politics.
Now, let's segue from that to someone that we do not see in the national media debating on these issues, and that's Gerald Salante. In fact, next weekend, I'll be lecturing with Gerald and Paul Craig Robertson, a relatively strong group of people who are going to look at all the issues in the world and put forth some papers on some possible solutions. Here's Gerald Salante talking about this area of the world.
I honor thy founding fathers, beginning with George Washington, at his farewell address, no foreign entanglements. And then you listen to Franklin and Adams, Jefferson and Madison, no foreign entanglements. And the world was at war back then. The Middle East policy in the United States has been nothing but disaster after disaster. I would say to anyone in Washington, from the President to Congress to the Senate, fix Detroit first. Stay a night over in Trenton. Go to East St. Louis. Go around the country. Fix up all these rotting cities. Then tell me how you're going to fix the Middle East. Don't give me the baloney that you're making me safer by going in other countries, destroying the joint, and then say, oh, I wonder why they hate us. Anybody ever hear of do unto others you have them do unto you? I love these guys that talk about protecting the unborn and protecting our children while they are killing people all over the world. Who made up this thing about the United States advancing democracy when they're robbing us of all our rights over here? And this whole insanity that we have to continually be in a state of war is just that. There's no reason for it. No foreign entanglements.
Well, I would share a little difference of opinion with Gerald on his last statement. What is the motive? There's no motive, then there's no reason to do it. But Gerald, profit, trillions of dollars in profit, by having a perpetual war machine and all the thousands of subcontractors and contractors, many of whom used to be legislators or work in the Defense Department or the national security agencies. So it's very profitable for them. Now, I want to spend the remaining portion of our time today giving you some very detailed background on the voices for vaccine. These are facts that most people are not aware of. We want to thank Jeffrey John Odferheide from FactTruth for creating this. And first, we have a simple question. Do vaccine companies believe in their product? I believe it's no, they do not. They do believe in money and power. They answer only to their stockholders. If they believe in their products, they wouldn't require legal protection from their product harming children through Public Law 99-660, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. Furthermore, they wouldn't need to force parents to vaccinate their children through mandates. And therefore, Big Pharma and the pro-vaccine lobby know their ship is sinking. Parents are investigating vaccines and asking doctors questions they cannot answer in the way they have been taught. As a result, the entire Big Pharma, at least on vaccines, its safe and effective mantra, is beginning to crumble. So what do? Well, they enter a blog called Voices for Vaccine. Now write this down. Perhaps you've seen the recent story hosted on the website Voices for Vaccine, entitled Growing Up Unvaccinated. And as you can probably guess from the title, it is a story of a mother who grew up unvaccinated. And the woman in the story changed her mind in adulthood and decided vaccines were really beneficial to her health. And while this mother converted to the religion of vaccinology, there is an even bigger story underneath the surface if you simply look for it. If you haven't guessed by now, it has to do with the relationship between the Voices for Vaccines website in the pharmaceutical industry, which no one that I'm aware of in the mainstream media ever looked for. Let's take a look. These are facts. Everything I'm sharing with you now could be presented in a court of law. Fact one, the task force owns the Voices for Vaccine website. You should know that the Voices for Vaccine website is owned by the Task Force for Global Health. You've never heard of them? You should. They're the third largest charity in the United States. Voices for Vaccine claims it is, quote, a parent-led organization that supports and advocates for online vaccination and the reduction of vaccine-preventable diseases. And while the administrators of the website are noted as being two mothers, everything else is, well, it's channeled by some larger forces. Fact two, Task Force is the third largest charity in America. They bring in $1.66 billion a year, according to Forbes. Yet, if you're not from Atlanta, Georgia, chances are you probably haven't heard of the Task Force for Global Health. This fact alone should tell you there is big money involved. Fact three, the Task Force employees work for Emory University, all of their task force employees. Now that you know that the Task Force for Global Health owns the website, it's time to step into the deeper end of the pool. And before I show you who is influencing the website, you must know task force employees are actually working for Emory University. Now, the situation is a bit more complex when you look at the Task Force IRS tax form 990. Page 49 and page and their 2011 document states, quote, the Task Force for Global Health is an affiliate of Emory University, and as such, all Task Force employees are in fact Emory University employees. For both the president and executive vice president, Emory University includes these positions in its annual market review of compensated professionals in these categories, end quote. Now, fact four, the proximity of the Task Force and Emory University and the CDC. Now, I haven't discussed the CDC connection yet, but I will. Let's take a look at how closely the following three organizations are connected to each other. According to Google Maps, the Task Force for Global Health is located 2.6 miles from Emory University, and the Center for Disease Controls are located on the same campus. Now, fact five, influence the Scientific Advisory Committee. To understand who's controlling the energy for Voices of Vaccine and the Task Force organization at large, you need to understand their relationship and affiliations. It's enough to make your head spin. Let me give you an example of what I mean. And I have the complete layout. For example, with Voices of Vaccine, Alan Hinman, medical doctor, the director, and then Karen Ernst and Ashley Shelby, the administrative staff, and then the scientific advisory board. Dr. Paul Offit, Oh, Deborah Wexler, Stanley Plotkin, Alan Hinneman. Aren't those the ones we see all the time on television who are pro-vaccine? Yes. Alan Hinneman is the director for various positions within the task force, including its leadership. And he's on the scientific advisory board for Voice of Vaccine. He is director of the task force program. Accelerated Measles Mortality Reduction Improved Routine Immunizations in Africa program, which is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He is director of the task force program Rabies Vaccine Immune Globulin Emergency Stockpile, which is funded by Novartis Pharmaceuticals. He's an adjunct professor at Emory University. He's a former CDC Epidemic Intelligence Service officer. He is director of the Immunization Division of the CDC. He's on the scientific advisory board of the pro-vaccine organization Every Child by Two with Dr. Paul Offit. And here is more about scientific advisor member Paul Offit. He's on the scientific advisory board for Voices for Vaccines. He holds a patent on the rotavirus vaccine with Stanley Plotkin. You mean the same Stanley Plotkin? Yes, the same Stanley Plotkin who's an advisory member who goes forth. He worked with vaccine manufacturer Merck to create a vaccine and receive royalties. He has served as both a paid and unpaid member of the scientific advisory board at Merck. He's a former advisory committee on immunization practice member of the CDC. He's on the scientific advisory board of pro-vaccine organizations Every Child by Two with Alan Hinman. He's on the advisory board of the Immunization Act Coalition with Stanley Plotkin, led by Deborah Wexler. He's director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Center Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Of interest, that Deborah Wexler and Amy Pisani of Every Child by Two are also advisory board members of the Vaccine Education Center. And more about scientific advisor member Deborah Wexler. She's on the scientific advisory board of Voices for Vaccines. She's the executive director of the Immunization Action Coalition. And the Immunization Action Coalition receives funding from the CDC and pharmaceutical companies. And lastly, scientific advisor Stanley Plotkin is well accomplished within the vaccine community. He's on the scientific advisory board of the Voice of Vaccine. He's on the advisory board of the Immunization Action Coalition. He worked for the Epidemic Intelligence Service of the CDC. He's a former advisory committee on immunization practice member of the CDC. And hold on, he's an executive advisor to Sanofi Pasteur, who makes vaccines. And he's also on the board of director of Dynavax, which makes vaccines. And he was director of infectious disease and senior physician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he's also professor of biology at the Wistar Institute. And he holds a patent on the rotavirus vaccine with Paul Offit. Fact number six, the task force board of directors have relationships to the CDC and Emory University. And I have an entire list of all the people from the CDC and Emory University, and they're all co-joined. Plus, they have all these other people who have been pro-vaccine who are co-joined. And the task force was started by Rockefeller, UNICEF, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, and the World Bank. So if you look at the Task Force for Global Health, who started, it's important. According to their webpage, they were, quote, initially tapped to serve as a secretariat for a consortium of global health organizations, UNICEF, World Health Organization, the Rockefeller Foundation, the United Nations Development Program, and the World Bank, end quote. That's their statements. So, yeah, Alex Jones, you had that right. It's too bad that people on the left who think themselves so wise in promoting vaccines haven't done their homework. Because you see the people coming together. That's in their own words. Understanding the motives of the Rockefeller family, and as an example, is perhaps the best understood by author and researcher Lily E. Kay. She writes about the Rockefeller philosophy extensively in her book, The Molecule Vision of Life. On page 8, she says, quote, the motivation behind the enormous investment in the new Science of Man agenda was to develop a human sciences as a comprehensive explanatory and applied framework for social control grounded on natural, medical, and social sciences. Excuse me. What exactly is applied social control? Well, simply stated, it's the misuse of any branch of commerce, science, law, politics, or religion for compliance to an ulterior motive held by those in power. Lily Kay continues, quote, "With that agenda, the new biology, originally named psychobiology, was erected on the bedrock of the physical sciences in order to rigorously explain and eventually control the fundamental mechanisms governing human behavior, placing a particular strong emphasis on heredity." Excuse me, heredity? Do you mean eugenics? And better known today as genetics? Also, fact number 7, Emory owns stock in the vaccine company. Emory University stands to gain financially from vaccine research. The university owns 20% stock in a company called GeoVax. If you look into this company further, you'll see the complex set of relationships between Emory University, the CDC, the pharmaceutical company, Dr. Harriet Robinson, co-founder of GeoVax, developing AIDS vaccine technology. How did that happen, and how did that work out for you? Fact number 8, pharma pays Emory University. As a side note, Big Pharma pays out to Emory University, and that most people are not aware of. Also, Fact 9, programs funded by Bill and Belinda Gates Foundation, they're behind a lot of this. And the program is funded by Big Pharma, including Johnson & Johnson, GlaxoSmithKline, Novartis, Pfizer, Merck. Yep. And they partnered, the task force partnered with Merck for 25 years. Well, Merck has partnered with the Task Force for Global Health for 25 years through the McZion donation program. They have donated free pharmaceuticals to eliminate river blindness. And then they do the good work of vaccine trials. So in the conclusion, the next time one of the individuals appears on a radio show, Pacifico or any other, and claims that they're there to only for the interest of helping human beings, and they are not in any way compromised, do the homework. Because all of the people that I know out there promoting vaccines, I would say have massive conflicts of interest. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.